Welcome to Nonprofit Lowdown. I'm your host, Rhea Wong.
Hey, podcast listeners. Welcome to Nonprofit Lowdown. I'm your host, Rhea Wong. Today, I am speaking with Britt Savage, who is a manager at Bridgespan and the lead of racial equity and philanthropy initiatives. And today, we're going to talk about addressing structural racism through philanthropy. Britt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here today.
So, Britt, before we jump into the details of this really interesting report that you did, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you started at Bridgespan and how you became interested in racial equity and social justice?
Yeah, of course. And again, my name is Britt Savage, and I was born and raised in Virginia by my mom, a white Midwestern lady, and my dad, a Black man from Baltimore. And so growing up, biracial and with parents from very different backgrounds, very different families, race was a frequent and normal conversation in the house. And my parents really taught me to question the different norms around me, the different power dynamics that were present in the world, and what does it really look like to value difference? I was lucky they were very intentional about how they built up community around us and also just shared the history of my own family and really grounded us in that. My paternal grandfather was involved in civil rights movements around education and desegregation. And my dad is a nonprofit leader himself. And so growing up, I watched his work and would go to events with him and things. And I think that really influenced my career path in very obvious ways. And a big part of watching my dad grow up, in addition to being a real inspiration, was watching the way that he had to constantly try to get buy-in from folks in power and folks with money to see his vision come to life. And eventually, as an adult, finding my way to Bridgespan, where we're, you know, working with nonprofit leaders, working with philanthropists, I started really recognizing, you know, there's this responsibility I felt suddenly being in the decisions, being in the rooms where the behind-the-scenes conversations are happening and really channeling that experience I had growing up, and also recognizing the privilege I had in those spaces as someone biracial, as someone white passing. And just so that's a lot of the lens that I've taken to my work and why it's led me not just to Bridgespan, but also this specific intersection of racial equity and philanthropy.
Oh, that's so interesting. Thanks so much for sharing that. And it's always, I always love getting people's origin stories, right? There's always a reason why you do the things that you do. So let's talk about this report that you put up called Unlocking Social Progress by Addressing Unlocking Social Progress by Addressing Structural Racism. We're going to delve deep into the details on this, but can you give us a general overview of the report and any surprises for you as you research this?
Yeah. So by way of background of how this piece came about, we, after 2020, and there were a lot of folks talking about the importance of funders getting more involved in addressing structural racism, we were hearing a lot of hesitations or questions from funders about what does that really mean? What does that really look like? I think oftentimes to them, it sounds really ambiguous or really overwhelming of, wow, but racism is such a big issue. How can I really, where do I get started? How can I make a difference? And so the inspiration for this piece was really, one, helping to demystify what folks are trying to get funders to understand and to get the money off the sidelines ultimately. And also just inspire more hope that change is really possible. This sense that, oh, can you really ever resolve racist issues? It's like, we wanted them to walk away. Yes, progress is possible and you have a role to play. And so we collaborated with the Racial Equity Institute to really I think cornerstone of the report is the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative, which is an effort out of North Carolina working to address, in this piece, we talk about their efforts specifically to address disparities in cancer treatment. And we use that example as well as some others really focused in the South to illuminate the different elements of the work of what does it really look like to achieve structural racism. And that effort has gone on for over 18 years and still exists today. And so just really painting the picture of the story of that work, what that took, and trying to highlight some lessons for funders.
So what I really appreciated about the report was that it moves the conversation from kind of individual interventions that one funder or one foundation might take and really tries to elevate it to a systems level approach. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that it all starts with this radical clarity about the problem, about what the problem really is, right? Like, I think one really harmful narrative that is all too common in philanthropy is this idea that the problem is some sort of behavior change is needed on the part of the individual, or individuals just need help in these different ways, or there's something wrong with them. And that often will lead you to a programmatic band-aid solution. And this is really about acknowledging that I mentioned Racial Equity Institute, and they use the groundwater metaphor. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's this idea that if you think about a lake and one fish is sick or dying, then you wonder what's wrong with the fish. But if all the fish in the lake are dying, you wonder what's wrong with the lake water. But if a bunch of lakes all in one area have all the fish have died, then you realize it's in the groundwater. And that's really what structural racism is. It's infected every system in society. And so I think that like clarity around that really unlocks a whole different way of looking at the work. And if you just think about the magnitude, the generations that this has been a problem, it becomes very clear that no one organization alone is going to resolve it. It really takes this ecosystem view. It takes really encouraging collaboration instead of competition and understanding the different roles that folks can play.
So one of the things that struck me as I read the report, and it just seems like, duh, obvious, has not been necessarily a practice, is engaging the people who benefit from the intervention in the solution and listening to communities of color. And I was just, that seems very obvious to me. And yet perhaps it's not. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's funny to hear you say it's obvious. And I completely agree. Whenever I talk about this piece and much of my work, I really hesitate to use the word findings. None of these insights are new. I'm certainly not the first one to say them. BridgeBand's not the first one to say them. Really just how do you get the messages more normalized among the folks in power? Because anyone doing the work on the ground has known these things for decades and generations. But that aside, I think to your point about the real importance of listening and to communities of color and those closest to the issues, I mean, it's so obvious, right? Like the folks who are closest to the problem, who are living it day to day, like they are positioned to identify the solutions that are needed. And it's not just listening. I think a lot of times when folks say you need to get closer to the ground, listen to the folks who are closer to the issues, it can sound really superficial. And I think in the work that we did, it was really clear that it's not only listening, it's really valuing what they're saying. It's really valuing their expertise, understanding that they aren't saying these things, they aren't organized, and they aren't doing this work in just an activity, right? This is their life. This is organizing is not, it's also not just this political exercise, right? I think that's oftentimes what makes funders really nervous about getting closer to communities who are doing organizing and advocacy. It's really about an act of survival. And so when you are in deeper relationship with organizers, when you understand the stakes, when you understand what they're saying and really listen and act on what you're hearing, I think that really just makes the work so much more effective.
So I have a spicy question here, which is post-George Floyd, in the wake of decolonizing wealth, the trends of trust-based philanthropy and funding Black-led organizations, I think it all sounds really great. But what's it actually going to take to make this change both actually happen and sustain over time? Because I also think what's true is that philanthropy tends to be very predominantly white. And really, the history of philanthropy in this country is rooted in structural racism and a noblesse oblige. So I'm just curious, from your perspective, is a change real?
The change from 2020 real?
Yeah, is it real and is it sustainable?
It's really a great question. And I think that the reality is philanthropy and all systems of power are really cyclical. There's progress and then there's reactions. And I think we've seen backlash in a lot of ways in recent years. And so it takes a steady fight over time in order for it to be sustained. I think the jury's a little bit still out on how much funders who did start leaning into the trust-based practices, how many are really keeping those over time as the pressure comes off or as the context change. And because I know a lot of funders really do often default to their comfort zone. And so I think that if the work were done, then, you know, racism wouldn't exist anymore. And that's certainly not the case. And so I think just continuing to keep steady progress, and there are funders who are doing that, who are staying committed, and it's going to take the pressure staying on. And I think that's a lot of the story of the report we wrote, that it's great to work in partnership with institutions to really help them understand how they can be better and address racism entrenched within them. And that's not going to sustain in the long term. You also need accountability from the community, from the folks working outside of those institutions, to ensure that there is steady progress when the winds inevitably.
Do you think that, or let me ask this question, how important do you think it would be to see representation of people of color at the highest levels of philanthropy? Because again, we can talk the talk, but when we look around the table, when we look at the decision makers, I don't know that we see sort of the representation and diversity that we would want to see. So curious about your thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah, it is critically important. And I think, I'm not sure, I haven't seen the latest numbers, but definitely anecdotally, it feels like we're making progress in that dimension. A lot of racial equity organizations that I work with and talk to, oftentimes when they talk about funders who have championed them, it's a lot of program officers of color who are doing whatever they need to do to make sure that the money is flowing to the organizations doing the right work. And I think in conversations around diversity, I think that it's important for folks to really internalize that it really leads to a different outcome, not just because you have, okay, it's nice to have a bunch of different faces around a table, but there are real assets that people bring when they are drawing on different value systems, different cultural upbringing, different community experiences, and bringing that into the room and encouraged to do that. So I think it's critically important to have more diversity across all levels of philanthropic organizations, and for that to be like truly valued, to really pull out those assets and recognize and be excited that the folks are bringing something different to the table.
So I'm just curious, it's now 2023, 3 years mm-hmm. after the Black Lives Matter, I wouldn't even say the start of the movement, but I think a lot of the publicity that came after the George Floyd murder. Have we seen any meaningful changes in the number of Black-led organizations being funded?
I believe the answer is yes. I don't know the exact stats on the top of my head. But yes, I think that there was a huge influx of capital, obviously, in 2020 and in 2021. I guess there were a lot of commitments in 2020, and then some of those have started to be realized. I think that one concern, or not even one pitfall that I hope that philanthropy doesn't fall into, is expecting that in one grant cycle of really capitalizing those organizations, it's all of a sudden going to unlock all of the change that we've been waiting for. And my hope is that funders really understand that these problems that have been going on for centuries and the undercapitalization that's been going on for leaders of color are not going to be solved in a grant cycle. They're not going to be solved with one grant. They're not going to be solved in 3 years. They may not be solved even in one decade. And so staying the course.
You know, what really strikes me as I'm reading this report is it seems that it would take a great deal of humility for philanthropic leaders to take a step back and A, acknowledge that they don't know everything, B, trust the folks on the ground doing the work, and C, perhaps a willingness to themselves step back from their positions. And that seems like a lot to ask. And I'm just wondering, I don't know if there's a question here, but are you optimistic that this will happen? Because the other thing is, and again, very broad brush, but people who enter philanthropy tend to stick around for a really long time. And I just don't see, because it just feels like in order for cultural change to happen, there has to be a changing of the guards. And so I guess I'm curious from your perspective, do you see this happening?
Yeah. I think that picking up on your phrase of changing of the guards, I think in family foundations, anecdotally, we're seeing this a lot as like younger generations are inheriting the money and have a different relationship with wealth, or maybe have been part of more of social justice conversations growing up. And so I think I'm optimistic there. To your point about humility, it's so true. That is not often something you hear in a sentence, right? Of, oh, funders are so humble. And so I definitely hear the skepticism. And I think one like reframe I might offer too that seems to resonate with folks is you really want to create a sense of belonging for even them in this movement, to see themselves as part of it. And one thing that I love about the story of the Greensboro Health Disparities Collaborative is they're an organization made up of community members, of folks in academia, of medical providers, and they have this beautiful contract, like values-based contract that they all sign as a group. And one of their norms is around really valuing what everyone brings to the table and the roles that they play. And so they are equal partners in the work, whether you are someone who is there because of your experience as a patient or whether you are there as a doctor. Those credentials, those titles, they leave them at the door. And I think there's a similar mindset needed amongst funders of really asking themselves what they bring to the table. And what they bring to the table most obviously is capital, money. And it doesn't have to be expertise. I actually think a lot of folks may be relieved to know, they may not admit it, but I think a lot of funders like really do feel that pressure to have the answer and expertise. And this is an offer to set that down and recognize you can bring other things. And maybe it's not just money. I think some folks may bring different social capital or other experiences, especially as hopefully philanthropy becomes more diverse. But so maybe that reframe is a little bit easier to imagine than folks just showing up maybe with all of the humility.
Yeah, it reminds me of one of the metaphors I love about a stone soup, which is we all have something to add to the soup. No one person is more important than the others, but that we all have to collectively come together to make this soup happen. It would be great. I'm a little bit more cynical, but I'd love to see that happen. But on that note, I'd be curious, are there any examples that you would point to of philanthropy really pushing and making progress in this regard? You mentioned one group, and I'm curious if there are other examples that you have.
Yeah, I think that one, we talked about more Black-led organizations getting funding. I think there have also been a lot of funds that are coming up that are really grassroots-based. And I think I'm really excited about the role that they can play because plenty of reason, I agree, I understand your cynicism, right? Like, are these institutions really going to even be able to learn how to operate differently? And I think so there really is a role for a lot of these intermediary funds that are closer to the work, who do have the relationships, who do have the values, and are just set up differently to help with a lot of that and to really role model what it can look like as some of the bigger institutions learn their way into this. One that comes to mind is, I know you've had on here before, like the North Star Fund, right? I think that's an example of the type of funds that I'm talking about. And another example we talk about in the piece is a funder in Georgia who's a small family foundation called the Sapelo Foundation. And they do a lot of work to support power building, and coming out of 2020, poured resources into four different place-based networks and coalitions that were in different stages of development across Georgia. And it's not a perfect example, but we really liked how they were respecting the organizing work that was already happening and really taking that lens of how they could support strengthening it.
One example that comes to mind too, and we don't necessarily have to talk about it if it's, you don't want to, but I find that Ms. Mackenzie Scott's approach is interesting, and I hope it serves as an example to other wealthy individuals who are thinking about supporting organizations. But in particular, I appreciate the fact that she is not requiring a bunch of hoops to jump through, that she's not requiring onerous reporting, and that she's making it general operating unrestricted support. I'm curious, do you think that, I'm asking you to prognosticate, do you think that there's a world where we'll see more of that kind of individual giving?
I hope so. And I think that what is really exciting about that example is I think people can often feel like it's just really complicated, that they're, I just don't know, like, how do I find these organizations? What do I do? And there are all of these. So yes, it creates all these hoops for nonprofits. And I think they're creating a lot of hoops for themselves that they feel they have to jump through. And at the end of the day, it doesn't, I think it's an interesting example to show, like, if the goal is getting money out the door, you can actually just decide to get money out the door.
What's interesting is you're talking about this concept of trust-based philanthropy, because I think it certainly speaks to the trust that philanthropy should have in the nonprofit leaders. But I also, I'm just thinking out loud here, I've never worked at a foundation, but it also seems to me that some of the due diligence and perhaps the onerous due diligence that program officers find themselves doing is because of perhaps a lack of trust from a board perspective of, are you stewarding this money properly? So I'm curious, is that, can, are you able to speak to the ways in which trust has to operate within an institution in order to get to this new world?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there is a role that boards definitely play. I've also participated in a cohort with Justice Funders, where it's really a community of practice around different folks in the philanthropic spaces. And I know a lot of those conversations were folks grappling with how to get their board to buy in with these more trust-based processes. And I think that there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from groups that are doing work to address structural racism, actually. And oftentimes when funders are trying to figure out how to operate in a better way, they look to their peers, they look to each other. But even just taking some of the examples that we talk about in this, building trust is part of, it is so core to racial equity work, so core to community-driven work. And so there's a lot that can be learned even just from looking at those efforts. And at the end of the day, it all comes back to relationships and creating the space for that, for it to not be transactional, to really understand who it is that you're working with. And so you can understand what you're bringing to the soup, to go back to your metaphor, right? I know that sounds really fluffy, especially in the context of a very hierarchical institution and organization, but I think it does start there at least. And certainly there are like very tactical processes of what that can look like and trying to navigate, okay, like what really does need board approval and where are there loopholes and we can get creative. A lot of this work is also just folks getting creative, because building trust is a long-term game and this work feels very urgent. And so it's balancing. And I think as a person of color, this is just true of experiencing the world of in any given moment, choosing when am I going to navigate around the system and try to find a loophole so I can get the work done that I feel is important, and where do I take that longer term work to change what I'm seeing here as the problem.
So if I'm listening to you and I'm connected to a funder, a foundation or whatever, and it does feel like a very big, a tall order, right? How do I even get started, especially if I'm a smaller organization? I'm like, Britt, this sounds great, but I'm not the Ford Foundation. Like, I don't have all these like resources and staff members to drive us forward. Like, how do I begin?
As a funder?
Yeah, as a funder.
We hear the sentiment a lot.
I'm sure.
This is definitely a conversation I've had. And the maybe flippant answer is just start anywhere. Just start. I don't know. Just do literally anything. But that's not helpful. So to get more concrete, I think there are three main areas where we really encourage funders to look at them, their practices and their organization. On the internal side, there's their own talent and culture. So looking at their recruiting, looking at their trainings, looking at talent development processes of how are you deciding who gets promoted? How are you building the future leadership of the organization? Are you doing that in an equitable way? And then on, you know, more in the work itself, there's the sourcing and diligence processes of, are you disaggregating data? Do you even know who you're giving money to? Are you looking at your diligence processes and criteria and trying to find where the bias lies? And in your own strategy, are you setting clear goals about, are you naming the role that race plays in the issues that you care about? Are you identifying specific populations that are most impacted? And so I just listed a lot of things. And I think that we often see folks start in one of three places: in hiring. So really getting people who are more diverse and really are more fluent in equity. And I feel the need to caveat of, please don't just hire people of color and expect them to solve all your racist problems as an organization. Like, that is definitely not the advice.
Thank you for flagging that, because we've seen that happen a lot too. Yeah. Tokenism and, oh, we'll just make the people of color do all the equity DEI stuff and we'll be fine. We'll check that box.
No. Yeah. So that is not where to start. So I really think where I've seen it work really well is in the disaggregating data, so you understand even your own starting point and the setting clear goals, because that can just that can be helpful to unlock a number of natural next steps. And that doesn't require a lot of staff. That doesn't require it's not a ton of extra work if you're even just a nimble organization.
Let me ask you this, because as folks listening to Nonprofit Lowdown are often in on the nonprofit side, not necessarily on the philanthropic side, what can nonprofit leaders do to, I don't want to say push an agenda, but push an agenda, or at least bring this up to the surface with their funders?
Yeah. It's a great question. And a lot of my work is also with nonprofits as well. And I think that I preface any advice to nonprofit leaders with, the onus should not be on you to behave differently. Like, it is, the onus is on philanthropy. Like, nonprofit leaders don't need to now start saying, okay, I'm going to do steps 1 through 5 to solve racism in philanthropy. Like, philanthropists need to sort this out and figure it out and get themselves together. That said, in the relationships that folks have, one goes back to what we were talking about the different roles that folks can play. And I think being clear on, what role do you want your funders to play? I think a lot of leaders that I talk to, they're like, I don't want to add to my list of things changing hearts and minds of my funders. I would like them to provide the money and not get out of the way, but get out of the way. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable path to take. And so you don't necessarily have to feel like you have to be the one to bring along your funders. That said, I also talk to plenty of leaders who do want to do that. And I think it starts with really knowing what you value as a person and as an organization, and being really unapologetic about that and explaining, this is why this is important for the work. And it's not this moral imperative, it's a strategic imperative. And let me tell you why, and not shying away from that conversation.
Yeah. And I just want to underscore here too, that I think the funders who truly are partners in the work will be open to the conversation. And they're probably the ones most likely to actually engage in this anyway, as opposed to funders that are much more kiss the ring, as it were. So Britt, as we're wrapping up, any last thoughts or advice to folks in the field who are really wrestling with stepping into this new world of addressing structural racism? And also, we're not there yet, right? We still have an entrenched culture. Any thoughts, advice, encouragement for folks?
Wow. I think that it is, what I'll offer to folks who are either leaders doing the work, trying to address the racism that they see in their own communities, and to the funders who are learning about this, is to really start asking, like, anchor on the what if. You know, what if we do resolve this? And I think in philanthropic spaces, especially, folks are asking the wrong what if. They're like, what if it fails? What if it doesn't go well? What if people get mad at me? And I think asking the what if we really resolved the structural racism, what would this world look like? What if we really gave folks the capital and resources that they need? Like, what, and what if we didn't? I think that these like conversations about risk are defined in the wrong way. Like, the risk is that folks aren't given the capital they need to really get the change. The risk is that we keep operating in a world that's the way it is right now, and it's just the status quo. And to go back to the one of the main reasons why we wanted to write this report, it was to inspire hope that change is possible. And I will say that organization we talk about, they closed the disparities in cancer treatment. They did it. And I know it's just one example in a hospital in one place, but those are lives that are saved. And no, it's hard, but it is possible. And so I really hope that folks can feel that even amongst all of the challenges.
I am so glad I asked that question. That's a beautiful answer. So Britt, I will make sure to put your information in the show notes if folks want to get in touch via LinkedIn, and I will make sure to link to your really excellent report. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And until next time, take care, everyone. Hi, if you're a fan of Nonprofit Lowdown, you might be interested in my weekly free newsletter where I send out weekly inspiration for fundraising, notices about any upcoming events I'm doing, and a cute dog picture. So check it out at riawong.com, riawong.com.